Do you think people are born evil or made evil? Or maybe rather than people being evil, do you think that ordinary people just sometimes do evil things? It may be that you join with those who think that humanity is good. Not just that we were created good in the first place, but that we remain good. Let's have the first slide up, Jonathan, please. Some of you will be aware of a guy called Steve Chalk. Sadly, he is one of those church leaders who has drifted a long way from what the Bible teaches. And he has been sort of saying recently that what happened in the Garden of Eden when Adam and Eve rejected God and disobeyed what he told them was not original sin. It wasn't sort of a disobedience. It wasn't a bad thing, but rather it was the growth of humanity from innocence to knowledge. He says that we shouldn't read that story as some kind of curse descending on the whole human race. Which is interesting when the New Testament says sin came into the world through one man, that is, through Adam. For Steve Chalk, this is a story of the growth of humanity to maturity. No evil, only good. Earlier this month, I came across that quotation I've put on the sheet from Stephen Hawking. I think he's got it better, hasn't he? He seems to understand the human condition better than Steve Chalk. He puts it in his own sort of terms. Evolution has inbuilt greed and aggression into the human genome. That seems to be more like sin came into the world through one man and has passed from generation to generation. Thanks, Jonathan. You can take that away for the moment. And if that is the understanding we have, then we can see that there is no hope within humanity. We cannot save ourselves. We can never stem the tide of oppression and unkindness that we see in our world. There is no new leaf to be turned over. And that obviously goes on to tell us that we can't actually look towards human leadership to make any long-term difference. As we've learned already in the book of Judges, the good leaders will die and the evil ones will just do us more harm. And sometimes, as in the case of Gideon, the good ones will become evil. Now, last time we saw how Gideon was weak and wobbly, but how the Lord was strong and stable. And we saw how when Gideon put his trust in the Lord, when he acknowledged his need of the Lord, then God could use him and did use him as the rescuer of his people. But it appears that as the story goes on, Gideon begins to believe his own publicity. He begins to believe that he really is a big man, a mighty man of valor. And in so doing becomes a menace both to God and his people. And when his son Abimelech takes over from him, he proves to be a one-man wrecking ball both within the nation and his family. And the way in which our author tells us things are getting worse, tells us that we're on the slide, is in two ways. The first way he tells us that is because from verse 24 of chapter 7, the Lord, that is the covenant God of Israel, is not active in the account and never speaks. He is essentially absent from the account. Instead, we get reference to God, a much more generic term, and that only a couple of times. And maybe that reflects the changing understanding of the people at the time. They'd lost sight of their covenant God, the one who had made great promises to them and rescued them from so much. And instead, they were falling into the way of thinking of the locality, just talking about God. Maybe in the way that we sometimes find ourselves tempted, if we're Christians, not to talk about Jesus anymore, but just to talk about God. That's the first way the author tells us things are on the side. The second way he does it is by giving us a conclusion. He tells us what he wants us to draw from this narrative. Turn over to page 252 and go to the bottom right-hand corner of that page. Verse 56, right at the bottom of that page. Thus God returns the evil of Abimelech, which he committed against his father in killing his 70 brothers, and God also made all the evil of the men of Shechem return on their heads. What our author is telling us is that evil, greedy, aggressive humanity will not win. They cannot win. There's a higher court to which all are accountable. And be it in this life or the next, such people will receive their just deserts. So you see, the human story is not about growing from innocence to knowledge, not about growing from innocence to maturity. It's about the flowering of evil in greed and aggression. It's about God's just judgment on people. But above all, it's about his mercy towards a rebellious humanity. Well, let's have a look at Gideon and then Abimelech, and then we'll come back together and draw some conclusions. We're going to carry on from chapter 7 and verse 24. So we'll read through we'll follow the story through from there. And the first thing we see is the fear of missing out. Now, FOMO is one of the great fears of our age, isn't it? Somebody who works for a student Christian organization sent me his prayer letter recently, and one of the things he was giving thanks for was the fact that he was no longer entrapped by FOMO as he had been. We know that fear of missing out, don't we? That's why we're glued to our phones and mobile devices all the time. We're worried about missing that latest reply. We're worried about not knowing the venue for the after-work drinks. We're worried about not being invited to sign the letter to the BBC management about the equality of their pay structure. The fear of missing out. Here, we see it in the Ephraimites. There really is nothing new under the sun, you see. What are they cross about? 8:1 tells you. Then the men of Ephraim said to Gideon, "What's this you've done? Not to call us when you went to fight with Midian." They're cross that they missed out, except for the very end, in the battle against the Midianites. In this instance, Gideon's calm and diplomatic words turn aside their wrath. And verse 4 of chapter 8, we then see Gideon's pursuing a personal vendetta. Now, we might think that what he's doing from here on is simply a mopping up operation, finishing off the job with the Midianites. But if you look at verse 4, you'll see he crosses the Jordan. He goes out of the land to other territories. Turn over the page to verse 18, and we discover why he's doing this. He talks to these two kings, Zeba and Zalmunna, and he says to them, verse 19, those you killed, those who you say resembled the sons of a king, they, verse 19, were my brothers, the sons of my mother. And as the Lord lives, if you had saved them alive, I would not kill you. Why is he pursuing the Midianites? Because he wants vengeance on the Midianites. Gideon has exchanged this divine agenda for personal ambition. Back in verse 20 of chapter 7, the battle cry when they went to confront the Midianites was a sword for the Lord and for Gideon. But now, it's just a sword for Gideon. This force chosen by God to fight for the freedom of the nation becomes his private army. A force chosen by God to bring glory to him now brings glory to Gideon. Gideon's motivation, it's not national deliverance or divine command, it's personal vengeance. And it extends to those who don't support him. The people of Succoth suffer because they don't support him. Have a look at verse 16 of chapter 8. Gideon took the elders of the city of Succoth, and he took thorns of the wilderness and briars with them, and with them taught the men of Succoth a lesson. Well, that's a bit sort of soft. That's rather smoothed out what the original says. The original says he threshed them with the briars. That's pretty unpleasant, isn't it? What's going on here? Gideon is no longer contending with and killing the enemies of Israel. He is now contending with and killing his own people. Now, we understand the temptation to get even with people, don't we? We know how we want the last word in that online spat that we've got involved with. Maybe we are seeking to engineer the downfall of a colleague at work. Maybe we want to see someone from our friendship group's reputation trashed. Picture, please, Jonathan. You may have seen reports in the press recently about a Japanese wife who decided to take out her vengeance on her ex-husband by trashing his $1.5 million violin collection. And there are some pictures from that carnage. We understand getting even. We understand vengeance, don't we? Thanks, Jonathan. Take that away now. Tragically, in Gideon's case, verse 19, he seeks to claim God's support in it. They were my brothers, the sons of my mother, as the Lord lives. It's a poignant reminder of what he was before. And our narrator gives us a glorious picture of that. Well, is it glorious? It's probably not glorious at all, is it? Verse 20, he says to Jether, his firstborn, rise and kill the kings. But the young man did not draw his sword, for he was afraid. Those of you who were with us 3 weeks ago will think that sounds a bit like the earlier Gideon, doesn't it? It's as though Gideon comes face to face with his younger self, who in those younger, better days was afraid. And then from verse 22, we see Gideon's rule. This victory over the Midianites sees him being offered the rule of his people. Verse 22, rule over us. The invitation is not be king over us. There's different words that can be used for that. This is just a more general rule, but you'll see, and Gideon understands it, to be the offer of a hereditary rule. Israel has never done that. That's not part of their sort of remit at the moment. Your son and your grandson. Gideon's response seems to be a model one. I'll not rule over you. My son will not rule over you. The Lord will rule over you. But if you look at actually what happens and how Gideon behaves, you'll begin to see that these are empty words. First of all, notice verse 22, they say to him, you have saved us from the hand of Midian. Now, that's not the case at all, is it? It was the Lord who saved Israel from the hand of Midian. What would a godly, humble man say in that response? He would correct them, wouldn't he? He would say, no, it wasn't me, it was the Lord who did it. But Gideon is silent. Instead of that, verse 24, he asks for their tribute, a sign of submission to their ruler, and gathers together all this gold. And he also retains the trophies from his royal enemies. He takes on the king's role by establishing a cult. Now, that may make good sense, mightn't it? Politically, You don't want the people heading off to Shiloh, which was where the cult place was. You want to keep them close. You want to make sure that they're under your control. So you establish a shrine in your own town, which is exactly what he does. And this gold he gathers is used to make the idol. There's talk here of the ephod, which was really, you know, it's a big picnic blanket, effectively. It's a sort of rather glorious, expensive picnic blanket, more expensive than you've got, I expect. But it was used to cover the idol. That was its purpose. And what is the consequence of all this rule? Verse 27, all Israel whored after the image there, and it became a snare to Gideon and his family. In other words, they committed spiritual adultery with this. They've become like the Canaanites. They have their own shrines. And Gideon looks more and more like a Canaanite king. Verse 29, Jerubbaal, the other name for Gideon, went and lived in his own house. Now, you could think, oh, that sounds like retirement. Well, lived may be better understood as sat in his own house. Sat as in sat on his throne in his own house. Because the story continues in a way that would suggest that. He reads on to tell us he has a harem. He has many wives and at least one concubine. And this one concubine bears him a son. End of verse 32. He called his name Abimelech. Now, the names we give our children are names we like, maybe family names. They don't generally have significance because of their meaning. Abimelech means the king is my father. Gideon has received much from God, but Gideon of all the judges does the greatest harm. Despite that, the end of verse 28, the land has rest for 40 years. What is Gideon's legacy? We talk a lot about legacy these days, don't we? What is Gideon's legacy? Verse 33, as soon as Gideon died, the people of Israel turned again and whored after Baals and made Baal-berith, who seems to be the god of Shechem, their god. They don't remember the Lord. Amazingly, despite Gideon's bad behavior, he did seem to have some sort of inhibiting effect on what was going on in the nation at large. And once he's gone, all hell breaks loose. They return to the worship of Baal. Jerubbaal, you remember the name given to him by his father, means Baal has contended. And you have to conclude as you come to the end of Gideon. Baal hasn't just contended, but Baal has won. And that gives place to Abimelech, who basically does the stuff his father does, only does it sort of more so. He is the son of the concubine mentioned in verse 31. And he persuades the people of Shechem, his mother's family, that he should be their king. After much better to have one rather than the 70. How can the 70 sons rule together? That would be hopeless, be chaos. Much better have a family member, somebody who comes from this town, wouldn't it? And they agree. They fund his project through the temple coffers. And he heads off to Ophrah. And there, he kills his brothers. And you'll notice verse 5 of chapter 9. He does it on one stone. Was it the stone of a slaughterhouse? Was it the stone of a temple or a shrine? On one stone, one after the other. Just imagine the horror of that. And they make him king, verse 6, by the oak of the pillar at Shechem. Again, part of their religious paraphernalia. But there is a survivor. Jotham, the youngest son, has survived. And he escapes. He finds a place where he can talk to the assembled company. And he tells them a story. It's a brilliant story. I will read it to you from verse 8. The trees once went out to anoint a king over them. And they said to the olive tree, reign over us. But the olive tree said to them, Shall I leave my abundance by which the gods and men are honored and go to hold sway over the trees? And the trees said to the fig tree, you come and reign over us. But the fig tree said to them, shall I leave my sweetness and my good fruit and go to hold sway over the trees? And the trees said to the vine, you come and reign over us. But the vine said to them, shall I leave my wine that cheers God and men and go to hold sway over the trees? Then all the trees said to the bramble, you come and reign over us. And the bramble said to the trees, if in good faith you are anointing me king over you, then come and take refuge in my shade. But if not, let fire come out of the bramble and devour the cedars of Lebanon. And so saying, Jotham invites the people of Shechem to reflect on what they have done, how they managed to invite this bramble who will set fire to the whole place to rule over them. Verse 15 is an interesting image, isn't it? Because cedars of Lebanon grow up to 40 meters tall. Now, I'm a pretty bad gardener. I've had some overgrown gardens in my time. I've never had 40 meter high brambles, though. But we get the picture, don't we? The point is, verse 16, if you've acted in good faith and integrity, then all well and good. If not, you may expect destruction and bloodshed. And that is coming because of the way in which they have treated the family of Gideon. If you dealt well with Jeroboam, his house, then this would not happen. The words of Jotham are fulfilled. God ensures that there's a falling out between Abimelech and the leaders of Shechem, verse 23. This guy Gaal, verse 26, comes to take over. Abimelech is told in verse 31 and comes to attack and defeat Gaal. Death and destruction follow. But Abimelech doesn't stop there. He goes on to attack defenseless people, verse 42, the people going out into the field, and he ambushes them. And he then sets fire to the temple tower in which they have sought refuge, verse 46. So verse 49, we read these words. So every one of the people cut down his bundle of twigs of wood, brushwood, and followed Abimelech and put it against the stronghold. They set the stronghold on fire. So the people of the tower of Shechem also died, about 1,000 men and women. He seeks to extend his rule outside of the borders, this place called Thebes, wherever that may be. But this verse 53, the Bible does this every now and again. In these narrative things, you suddenly get a little comment like this. This comment in verse 53 is a delight, isn't it? And a certain woman. No idea who she is, but she's clearly very strong. Sounds like one of those sort of East German shot putters from the 1970s, doesn't she? And a certain woman threw an upper millstone on Abimelech's head and crushed his skull. Now, I don't know if we got any millers present. How heavy would an upper millstone be? And that is the end of Abimelech. 3 years of destructive, self-serving bloodshed, which has left the people in a worse state than before. So like the people of the surrounding neighborhood that they fit in seamlessly. They are thoroughly culturally appropriate. Three things to draw together as we close. First of all, we marvel at the mercy of God. We marvel at the mercy of God because after all this mayhem and this experiment with Canaanite kingship, which has palpably failed, God gives the country rest, peace, for 45 years. Just glance into chapter 10. After Abimelech, there arose Tola. He judged Israel for 23 years. After him arose Jair. He judged Israel for 22 years. Why on earth should God have treated them so well? It's not as though they were led unwillingly by their leaders. They were very happy with all this, weren't they? This was what they wanted, the direction they wanted to travel in. How many more chances should God give them? Why should God bother with an institutional church whose leaders have left the Bible behind and don't want to hear from God? Why should God bother with a world that is content in going its own way and satisfying its own desires, paying no attention to its creator? Now, of course, if you accept Steve Chalk's premise that everyone is good, then there's no surprise, is there? There's nothing to marvel at. In fact, humanity is just going on getting what we deserve. But if you recognize us for what we really are, then you will be filled with wonder. And you will give thanks and praise to this merciful God who doesn't give us what we deserve. That will encourage you to cry to him for mercy. And you will marvel that you've had the opportunity. We marvel at the mercy of God. But we also quake before the justice of God, because evil must be punished. As we heard in the video, God loves us enough to punish evil. That was the point of the story, verses 56 and 57 at the end of chapter 9. Evil people will get their comeuppance, partly because the seeds of their destruction are already sown in their behavior. I'm sure you can think of situations in your business life where you've seen people just go on acting in their pride, thinking they are untouchable and doing foolish things. We might think back to Fred the Shred and the takeover of ABN AMRO those years ago. We might wonder at what's going on in the White House at the moment with the conflict within the senior leadership there. But again, we think of the lies that administration has been built on. It's no surprise. The seeds of destruction are sown by evil. And here is a great general principle. The Creator God is a God of justice, and none shall escape. And as the video said to us, we rejoice with that, don't we? We don't want Stalin to get away with it. There are plenty of others throughout history we don't want to get away with. And the thought that they will get justice is an encouragement to us. Now here, of course, what we've been reading about is God's justice on his own people. They don't have a carte blanche just to behave as they like and do what they want. The church doesn't have that carte blanche. No individual Christian has that freedom either. Choosing to do what is right in your own eyes, choosing which God you will serve, deciding what you will accept as true in the Bible or you won't, satisfying your own desires at the expense of other people. Those are the evils for which there will be justice and punishment. Unless, of course, you think those things are simply steps on the road from innocence to knowledge and maturity, then you have nothing to fear. But if there is a God who will judge, if there is a God who is going to hold all to account, then we are foolish not to be ready, and we are right to quake. And lastly, we fall before the king who does not lead his people astray, the king who lives forever. Judges has told us that good leaders die. It's told us that evil leaders will do harm. It's told us that some good leaders will fall into evil. God's people, our world, needs a leader, needs a king who will not lead people astray, and who lives forever. Can you put the slide up, please, Jonathan? Thank you. And Peter tells us that this is the king we find in Jesus. Jesus committed no sin, neither was deceit found in his mouth. When he was reviled, he didn't revile in return. When he suffered, he didn't threaten, but continued entrusting himself to him who judges justly. He himself bore our sins in his body on the tree, that we might die to sin and live to righteousness. By his wounds, you have been healed. Notice in Jesus, there is no retaliation. There is no vengeance, despite being so unjustly treated. There's no shrinking from the responsibility of doing what his people, what the created people needed, that he might die for them. And having died, being innocent, he was raised to life and lives and reigns today. And we need a king like this because we are selfish. We need a king like this because we have chosen and continue to choose to go our own way. But of course, if you think you're good, if you think you're doing fine as you are, then this Jesus is not for you. You have no need of him. But for the rest of us, we will fall in awe before him because of who he is and because of what he has done for us. Because he took the punishment that was due to us on himself. God loved us enough to bear that punishment himself. And we will fall before him, because he is the King of Kings and the Lord of Lords, the one who deserves our service now and in eternity.